Hello, Josh.
Hey there, Glenn Lowry. How are things?
Oh, things are, at the end of the summer, winding down from, you know, being able to take each day and do whatever you wanted with it, read what you wanted, to now having to contemplate lectures,
day job,
appointments, meetings, memoranda, and all of that.
Yeah. Ugly day job coming back.
Yeah. I'm afraid I have to go to work again. I mean, you know, I get like 3 months off every year in this job that is like the best job in the world.
It is a good job, yeah.
Even with 3 months off, there are the other 9 months, which are beginning imminently.
Right. Well, I've got a couple of weeks left still. We don't start till the end of September, and I'm coming off being a little bit sick for a couple of days. So I hope you'll I hope you'll go easy on me.
Oh, come on, we're on the same side, more or less. You know, we're both. How does it go? All of us put our country first, right?
Both of us, in this case, put country first. Just like Glenn Lowry, I put my country first.
There you go.
Yeah. Right. So, country first. I wonder, Sarah Palin, new vice presidential candidate.
I mean, amazing, no? I mean,
amazing.
Is this not the most interesting election that at least I have ever beheld? You know, I mean, stuff keeps happening. That's really amazing.
It is pretty amazing. And, you know, I have to – I think it's really important to start, you know, with one point about this, which is, you know, we're both about the same age. Changes in the country over the course of our lifetime, pretty huge.
Yeah.
This is – great that here's a woman vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party, woman and mother of five, vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party. Outside our experience and outside our expectation, I think it's an important statement about you know, what's about changes that have happened in the country, and it's a, I think, at least to that extent, I think it's a very good thing. Of course, the downside of this, from my point of view, is that what it shows, you know, it stands for the principle that unqualified women should have exactly the same opportunities as unqualified men. And because I think the, you know, the main thing about this choice is that I think, apart from the upside that I just mentioned, you know, I think this is somebody who is just obviously not qualified. In fact, not a quarter to being qualified. And I want to give one example of it. There was a piece that I've read it a couple of places now. The blogosphere is alive with materials about the
I've been out there a little bit myself.
I bet. And there was this, an interview in early 2007 when Governor Palin was being asked about her views about Iraq. And she said, well, actually, she'd really been paying most of her attention to the governor's job. And she hadn't really thought about it very much.
Yeah, and that sounds like an honest answer.
Well, it had the I'm with you, Glenn. It had the virtue of being an honest answer, and to get that rather than getting some, you know, moronic, you know, version of the, you know, the party line, whatever party you're belong. That's is a good thing. But the thing is, I mean, let's be serious about this. 2007, country has been at war for 4 years. Several thousand, more than 4,000 Americans killed, more than, you know, Iraq in shambles, I mean, doing better since then. This is not somebody.
Russia on the march, Putin and company.
And she says, early 2007, she's a political leader, she's an elected governor, and she says she hasn't thought about this very much. It's true that it's an honest answer, but that's the problem with it, is that it's an honest answer. I think that is...
Outside the context of her having been chosen as a running mate and the prospect that she could become the vice president of the United States and therefore be a heartbeat away from the presidency, outside of that, I would think that response was unremarkable. The governor of a small state, I mean, big in geographic extension, but a small state... who is, a former municipal elected official, a small town kind of thing.
9,000,
You know, she hadn't thought much about Iraq. That doesn't, it wouldn't have surprised me, except that somebody chose her to be the vice presidential candidate, in which case it now seems to be evidence of the fact that she's insubstantial.
I wouldn't go so far as to say insubstantial. I'm sure I'm sure she is a totally amazing person. I'm sure she's smart, tough. You go into a fight with her, you underestimate her, and she'll hand your head to you. I have no doubt about that. And I think the dangers of her being underestimated, talked down to, are obvious and very great and being discussed already. But I think even in 2007, with the country having been at war for 4 years, for any politically aware, politically sensitive adult to say, whether you don't have to be governor, you're not a governor, anybody, you say you haven't thought about it very much, you don't really have a view about a war that the country is involved in. Now contrast that with other statements. For example, an interview in which somebody asks about climate change, and she says, well, Alaska will be hit particularly hard by climate change. I'm not quite sure why she thinks that, but anyway.
Glaciers are shrinking up there in almost a visible way.
If you look around the world, sub-Saharan Africa, where there are places that are living close to the edge for food, are going to be hit harder by this. But the point is, she then added that she was not one of these people who thinks that there are human sources of climate change. She didn't say, she didn't say, I haven't thought about this very much, although it was obvious. I guess she was taking her climate change courses from Senator Inhofe or something. But, obvious that she hadn't thought about it very much.
Okay, Josh. But, I hear you. I hear you, and I'm not arguing with you whatsoever. Yeah. I want you to know I don't disagree with anything you're saying. The logic is impeccable.
Yeah, but...
But here's what I think is... I don't know. Yeah. Do you play chess? You don't play chess.
Chess player. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I play chess. I like to play, online now. You can play all the time. You can play against really strong players.
Yeah.
And a guy makes a move, and the piece just seems to be hanging out there.
Yeah.
The move is incongruous. Incomprehensible.
Yeah, what we call a poison pawn.
Yeah, exactly. Poison pawn, poison bishop, the rotation knight. I mean, why is he doing that,
Yeah.
And I've got that feeling about this. I mean, this looks like somebody in a chess game who's, down and looks like they're in a bad position.
Yeah.
And if they just play normally, the vice will get tighter and tighter. Your advantage will accumulate. And by the end of the game, they'll just be lost. Okay? So they've lashed out and they've done something. And, my instinct as a chess player is to say, all right, it looks like a blunder. But what are the possible traps, what are the things that I need to anticipate that I didn't think about that, somehow if I fall for it, all of this blunder comes to make sense. And I have that feeling about this.
Yeah.
And I mean, to say it in brief compass, my feeling is the Republicans want to have a debate about culture. They want to make the election an argument, at least in part, an argument about culture.
Yeah.
And Sarah Palin, this evangelical, she could have been homeschooled. I don't know if she was, fierce, pro-life, not even in the event of rape or incest does she think abortion should be allowed.
Right.
Gun-toting, lifetime NRA, moose burger eating.
Right.
Beauty queen, mother of five children. I mean, as soon as we say how incompetent she seems to be, it feels like we're, these arugula eating.
Yeah.
If you didn't go to Harvard, you're an idiot. Unless you live within 10 miles of one of these metropolitan centers, one of these kind of snobs. And my fear is that's what this is about. This is about, sort of misdirection. It's about changing the conversation from all the things that you and I think we ought to be talking about in this election.
Yeah.
Policy, America's role in the world, the economy, taxes,
the budget deficit. All the things that John McCain has been talking about in the election. Now, maybe you're right. What he thinks is he's not going to win by continuing to talk about
those
things.
That's what I'm thinking. He thinks he's not going to win.
The person who's been pushing Sarah Palin the longest is Rush Limbaugh. he's been on this case for about 6 months now. And
I didn't know that because I don't listen to Rush, but that's very interesting.
James Dobson, he's all over this, like, you know, stink on shit. I mean, he thinks this is really a great thing.
Look what they've done. In other words, so the Obama phenomenon is, you know, this complex and amazing, you know, innovation in American politics, and this coalition that he's put together and this movement that has taken over the Democratic Party, and a piece of it is, you know, a lot of people were voting for him because he's this African-American, you know, hope for a new generation, this, you know, fulfillment of whatever, okay? And nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Yeah. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not disparaging that at all. They managed to find their own niche.
Yeah.
You know, if you count the number of people who are going to be attracted to her purely because she is a fundamentalist, pro-life, you know, red America, red-blooded girl, American girl, those numbers are probably comparable to the numbers of people in inner city Philadelphia or Baltimore or, you know, rural Georgia or whatever who are going to vote for Obama because he is the embodiment of these hopes and dreams and aspirations of this stigmatized and, you know, derogated social group that now of, you know, I mean, in other words, they managed to, you know, I'm not trying to equate the two persons.
No, I understand.
There's this move that's being made here that I think is very interesting.
Yes, I mean, the reason I started with the issue about qualification was because I didn't want to start with the politics of it. I mean, we can now talk about the politics of it, but I wanted to...
No, but let's talk about the qualifications more for a minute, because there's something I wanted to say about that.
Yeah.
And this may not be by now an original observation at all, but I also see the chess master's potential genius in this, which is that now there's all this conversation about qualifications.
Yeah.
And, of course, hers are scant.
They
are de minimis.
Yeah.
But when I hear people saying Obama is more qualified than she to be commander-in-chief, I cringe. I shudder. Because while that's true, I don't dispute it for a minute, the necessity to utter the sentence diminishes Obama.
Yeah.
You know? So now they got you talking about qualifications. And while hers may be scant, you go after it at your peril because you're going to seem condescending and dismissive.
Yeah.
The fact that you're talking about qualifications makes his an issue. You know, you can have answers to the issue,
right?
But that's what you're talking about. You know,
this,
that's not
this
what
is certainly. You know, Bertolt Brecht used to say that he thought that he liked to play chess in a way where you would change the rules each time you played. So this is
that's a hard game.
This is a game changer. It's a game changer. It's a rule changer. It has disrupted the conversation. All the things you're saying is true. I want to go back just for one more minute and say, here's the thing. John McCain is an infinitely smarter politician than me. So if I don't understand the move exactly, then I think he's got something going that I'm missing. So I'm sure this was not some dopey, blustering move on his part. And the things that you're saying sound right to me. I mean, Karl Rove responded to this by saying, great gun-toting hockey mom. So that's your point, but I just wanted to I wish Obama had picked Hillary Clinton, kind of in the team of rivals spirit. I think it would have been a real demonstration of strength on his part. Understand all the reasons for not doing it. The Atlantic article on Hillary's campaign doesn't make her seem like a great manager, and you got Bill running around like a madman doing his usual business. But I would have thought it was a good idea. But when he picked Biden, I thought, okay, when he was making this decision, somewhere pretty high up on his list of things that he wanted in a vice president was confidence that the person could do the job of president. A bunch of other calculations too, you know, Catholic, more identified with white working class voters, et cetera, et cetera. Some downsides, but that looked like it was on the list of things. When I think about what was on McCain's list in making the decision to choose Governor Palin, as his one, I don't see that it could have been anywhere on his list that she has the qualifications to do the job should, you know, some terrible thing happen to him. And that's what they was focusing on initially.
Now, I hear you, and I have to object. I mean, now what am I objecting to? I don't think you're I think it's a non sequitur that you're arguing here. In other words, I think what you're saying is
that good or bad?
In politics, I don't think it's clear whether it's bad or good. I think it's a question of will it work. but I mean, I think what you're arguing is the Obama choice was driven by a set of criteria and motivations that are creditable, whereas the McCain choice was driven by a set of criteria motivations that are in some way or another dishonorable. The Obama choice weighted the well-being of the country high amongst the various criteria in choosing somebody because, in addition to helping you win or lose this or that state, this is a person who with some probability could be in the position of president, and therefore you owe the country to choose someone who's qualified to do that. Whereas the McCain campaign made a choice based on these much more dishonorable sort of purely partisan motives of whatever they calculated, whatever that calculation might be, would help them win. And the reason I'm objecting is that I don't think, I mean, I'm not convinced that that's that there's really any difference between these campaigns with respect to the extent to which they will do what they need to do to win. I mean, I am talking about getting out of public financing, opting out. You know, that was a public good. It wasn't just for this election cycle. I mean, that changes the whole game. Obama's decision not to participate in the public financing system is a significant amendment to McCain-Feingold in terms of the structure of how we elect people in this country, not just this time around, but on down the line. Now, maybe he had to do it. Maybe it was smart and right for him to do it. Maybe at the end of the day, the country's better off for him to have done it. But certainly, the motivation for doing it was, what does it take to win? So, you know, this high-minded, we're better than them because, you know, I don't know.
I'm not talking in general terms here, Glenn, and I'm not, and we can have a discussion about the public finance issue. I am a strong supporter of public finance, and I think essentially the courts, with the Supreme Court in the lead, but also circuit courts in the United States, have done everything in their power to make the acceptance of public money a suicidal act on the part of a presidential candidate. So I think the courts have to share some of the basically you're tying your hands against independent negative expenditures.
Yeah, the 527s.
And so I didn't like that Obama did that. And Obama is, you know, as brilliant a politician, at least as John McCain is. I think he cares a lot about winning, and that's what this game is about, at least substantially. You got to do anything, you got to win. My point really is about this choice. And
okay,
I hear you in general terms, but I'm saying specifically about this. I regard McCain's. I'm not a really deeply hostile to McCain. I don't want him to win, but I don't think this is the greatest nightmare that the country has ever faced if he does win, partly because he's going to face a Congress with a 70-seat Democratic majority in the House, and probably 8 seats on the Senate side. So I don't think this is a terrible disaster. But I honestly say that the worst thing that I've seen John McCain do is to make this pick, not because it's politically stupid, I think it's probably politically smart, but because I think this isn't a risk, this is just a gamble with
the country. But what do you say then? What do you say to, because there are people out there who think this, I know.
Yeah.
What do you say to people who say the Democrats rejected, and now I have to declare that during the primary season, which was a long time ago, I did support Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
They rejected Hillary Rodham Clinton for hope and change and the excitement and exhilaration of a movement. And they put the country in jeopardy because the junior senator from Illinois has been running for president almost from the day he stepped onto the Senate floor, and had a pretty thin record before that. And while community organizer and eloquence is wonderful, it doesn't come anywhere near constituting the life experience that prepares somebody for this. Yeah. Now, there are people who believe that and who think that the Democrats are on some kind of trip.
Yeah.
You know, they're drunk on some kind of dreamy, cult of personality, and they're putting the country at risk.
Right.
Okay? And so here comes John McCain, back against the wall, Republican brand ruin, Bush an idiot, run the country into the ground. And he's doing what he needs to do to try to piece the thing together. And if you want to say nominating this woman of no particular distinction is putting the country at risk, well, yeah, but that ain't nothing compared to what the Democratic Party has done. And by the way, I just want to say that was a kind of hypothetical argument that I was making on behalf of this person out there. That's not necessarily my view.
I understand that you have an uncertain relationship to that argument you made. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, what you just said is John McCain has been saying more or less what you just said. You know, thin resume, no experience, this guy hasn't even been to Iraq. This is not a job where it's really good to get on-the-job training. That has been his argument. So what he did, not what, 18-plus million voters did over the course of a very long campaign where people have been fighting out the issues in public, where you got a guy who's written a couple of books, who's talked over a very long period of time about a wide range of national and international issues, who did win an election to the Senate. I mean, the Clinton campaign pointed out, he wrote an essay when he was in kindergarten about how he wanted to be president. This was not like a new thing for him. He'd been, on state level, but national and international issues for a long time. And as I say, he's, fought out, a very tough campaign against a bunch of very serious competitors and showed consistently that he was at least in the argument, if not able to win the argument, then won the election. So McCain makes this case, and then he picks somebody whose resume is unquestionably thinner. And this is not a point. Yeah, let me just be clear about this. This is not a point about the intrinsic abilities of this person. I'm sure an unbelievable person. Must be fantastically impressive.
Sounds like
impressive. Five kids. Governor. She has her fifth kid while she's governor.
I know. That's pretty amazing.
she wins in a state.
High school basketball star, beauty queen.
And I'm sure, smart and serious and tough and knows how to...
No doubt.
Apparently the stories about her popularity running in the 80s are not true. The Alaska newspapers say that they're running in the mid-60s and dropping. And the Alaska newspapers...
But Josh, let me interrupt to say something here. I mean, I hear you. I'm with you all the way. Yeah. But look what you're saying. What you're saying is... Sarah Palin is less qualified to be president of the United States than Barack Obama. Yeah. And I just want to reiterate, if that's what you're saying, Barack Obama loses. I don't care about the objective truth of that statement. If it's necessary to say it, that's what I see as the potential for a real genius in this.
Well, you're shifting the discussion. Yeah, I agree with you.
It's a way of them upping the ante or doubling down or something on the empty suit argument. By, in effect, choosing an empty suit, which underscores or makes more salient the empty suitedness as an issue. Because, people are not going to vote for
him. But you're making my point, Glenn.
And because the mortality risk really isn't that high. I mean, people say he's 72. Not that many people who are 72 die before they're 76.
I actually tried to figure out
people living to be 100 years old.
The life expectancy at age 72 is 10 years. I don't know what tail of the distribution is between 72 and 76. But I'm expecting.
Yeah. All I'm saying is, I really would not want to have that argument where one person says your guy for president is unqualified, and the other person says, "Yeah, but your guy for vice president."
I agree with you about that, and I'm taking your point. But I just want to come back and say, the way the conversation is going is, I'm saying that given the chance to choose somebody who had been a serious vice presidential candidate, obviously capable of stepping in if something happens to McCain, you're just reinforcing my point, which is that McCain chose to make a purely political calculation to treat this as entirely a game about winning, even though no one can make the case, certainly I haven't heard the case made yet, that this is somebody who at this point in her life, not 10 years from now or 5 years, but at this point in her life, is qualified to do the job. She's just not qualified. Even if you take Geraldine Ferraro, and Geraldine Ferraro said, look, I was picked because I was a woman, I wasn't particularly qualified. Geraldine Ferraro had spent 3 terms in Congress. She had held national office for 6 years before she was nominated. Miller.
Walter Mondale was a desperate man.
That's right. Well, funny that, maybe he's desperate, although when you're running pretty close to neck and neck, despite the fact that the economy is in the tank and a war has been going on for 5 years and people are moving.
Exactly. He's running with this anvil around his neck. He's neck and neck now, but he's got 60 days to go, and he knows that, this is what it's about. He ain't going to stand up, he's going to lose.
We can do what everybody else is doing on this choice, which is, speculate about what the reasons were. I agree with you about what you said at the beginning, which judge the choice and the calculations behind it by the people who came out, 15 minutes later, applauding it. Yeah, and that's the Rush Limbaughs, and it is the, the James Dobsons, et cetera. And I don't think that came as any great surprise to John McCain. I don't think this really is calculated to win over a lot of disappointed Hillary Clinton supporters. Interesting fact about Hillary Clinton supporters is there's been a lot of talk about how they're going to, some of them are going to jump for McCain. Women supporters of Hillary Clinton on the polling are showing up much less likely to jump for McCain than male Hillary Clinton supporters.
Oh, that's
so the idea that this is all about, gender identity and gender disappointment or something like that, I don't think that that's a big part of this calculation. I think you're more nearly right about it, but that just makes the point that I wanted to make, which is that putting the politics aside and judging this from the point of view of, sorry to use an old-fashioned phrase here, the good of the country, it's not so great. But maybe we've exhausted this.
Well, I want to talk about those speeches at the DNC convention last week.
Let's start with Senator Clinton's speech. What did you think about that?
Well, it's been remarked.
We'll get to Obama. We'll build up to.
It's been remarked how, magnanimous and, she did the right thing and so forth. And she did all those things. I thought it was a, more than serviceable speech. I thought it was a, I thought it was a good speech. And I, I'll sum it up this way. My son, Glenn, 19-year-old, going back for his second year at Haverford College, mm-hmm. wrote me after seeing the speech, and he's he views with a jaundiced eye. I mean, he's not gullible. He hasn't drunk anybody's Kool-Aid. He's not anybody's fan. He's always thinking his way through these things. And he said, "I wish he had chosen her. I wish he had chosen her." That was Glenn's reaction to the speech. Right. It was a sense that maybe an opportunity was missed because not only her 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling, but her her toughness, her maturity, her steadiness, her it could have been something special, he thought, after seeing the speech. And I must say, I kind of shared that sentiment. I felt after that. I wasn't all aglow. I had been a Clinton supporter. And I'm a Democrat, and I'm behind our nominee 100%. But at the moment of that speech, I guess I was up there with some of those sisterhood of pantsuits, of traveling pantsuits girls, and saying, right on, sister.
I'm with you. I thought it was a very emotionally moving speech. I thought she said, it was one of these things where she said exactly the right thing and in a very powerful and moving way, which is, it's not about me. Now, one reaction that you could have to that is, yeah, no kidding. It's not about you. Duh. I don't think that's right.
No, because not everybody has gotten that message. That it's not about
everybody has gotten that message, and she hit it exactly, and she put it, the way she put it in the speech was she started talking about the people who it was about.
Yep.
And these, very, extraordinary stories.
Yep.
And so I thought it was very good. I didn't think it was... at the same level of, you know, power and, you know, brilliant craft as was, you know, my reaction to that after
Before you go on to Bill Clinton's speech, I just wanted to ask you about what you thought about the concern that Hillary did not provide a kind of personal testimony on behalf of Barack Obama, which has been the one criticism that I thought had some weight that people were making of her speech, which is to say she could have said, you know, I was on the camping trail with this guy. We spent, you know, the better part of 2 years or 18 months or whatever it was, you know, battling for the, you know, whatever, and I'm here to tell you that, you know, he's ready to be president.
I don't know. I wasn't particularly struck by that. I mean, people have sliced and diced and talked about the things that she did say and that she didn't say, and, you know, that she said that Biden would bring, what was it, intensity to the ticket, you know, arguably making an implicitly disparaging. And I thought, you know, give it a rest. It was a very...
I think so. But she might have explicitly walked back from the 3 a.m. in the morning ads and whatnot. I mean, not apologize for it, but simply affirmed what she was negating in that part of her primary campaign. Affirmed that, while I may have thought then, I mean, again, she wouldn't want to say it this way because she wouldn't want to seem to be taking her words back, but simply to affirm, you know, the man is ready to be commander-in-chief.
With saying that is exactly the problem that you were raising about the Palin-Obama thing. If she says, hey, friends, this guy, I can tell you, he's qualified, and everybody thinks, oh, yeah, there was this concern about whether he was qualified or not. I don't think it answers the question. In other words, I'm not sure that you answer the question by answering
it. But she left it to her husband, and now, you know, we should talk about, you know, which he did say, and that was an important part of what he had to say.
He did, and I thought the main thing that I thought, when I listened to the speech and I thought, you know, this guy may be a totally self-indulgent asshole, but. Wow, you know.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought, he doesn't have the oratorical gift of Obama or Reagan for that matter. But I said it was an extremely carefully crafted thing, which was, you know, really framed the election. He said, there are billions of issues, but there are basically two big things that are at stake here. One is, you know, rebuilding the American dream, and the other is, you know, globally rebuilding these alliances that have been frayed and undermined and with respect to those two issues, this guy's the right guy. And I thought, as a framing of the election, that was a little bit better than Obama did the next night. But I thought
it was brilliant. Yeah. It was Clinton-esque. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, really. Yeah. It was. I thought it was masterful. I believe you're putting your finger. I can even remember some of the phrases. I mean, lead by the power of our example, and not the example of our power.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, come on. This is exactly right. And I mean, I've been saying this for months. Go after the foundation of this global war on terror. Yeah. To hell with the United Nations. Right. Freedom fries.
Yeah.
Jingoism.
Yeah.
And affirm that we actually need, you know, yes, multilateral and cooperative relations in order to get things done. Again, another Clintonism, the phrase is something like, there's no problem that we're confronting on the global scale that we can solve by ourselves.
Right.
There isn't any problem we can solve without the cooperation of other countries. It's not about whether you're pro-American or anti-American or, you know, or kind of quasi-French. Yeah. It's about whether you're self-interested and smart enough to realize that you need to cooperate with other countries.
It was very good. And I also thought he handled with, you know, really pretty powerfully and you know, gracefully and graciously the issue about Obama's being, you know, ready to lead, qualified for the job, talking, among other things, about the strength that you get, the knowledge and the strength that you get that comes just from being in this, you know, very competitive, you know, run for the president political environment over a very long period of time. It does make a big difference. Anyway, he had a plausible story to tell. You know, it was like part of, you know, people talk about the thinness of Obama's resume, and what Clinton said, and I think there's something to this, is that part of Obama's resume is that he's been running a tough campaign against some very serious competitors, including Hillary Clinton, over a very long period of time. He's been at it for a while, he's learned a lot from it, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought that was...
There was honest testimony on his part. I'm sure that comes from personal experience. And also his use of this device, which was to say, you remember back in 1992 when they said this governor from Arkansas, failed governor from a failed state, or whatever the rhetoric was.
Right.
You know, Arkansas was number 48 on this index, or 43 on this index of American states with respect to this or that performance measure. And they said, I wasn't ready either. And, you know, I mean, he didn't have to say it. We didn't do that now.
Now, what about the one, the big guy? Go ahead.
He's the one, as you say. I mean, well, you know, the spectacle, 80,000 people, 75,000 people this year. I mean, crying, screaming, mobs of whatever, you know, the masses. This staged setting, this craft of image projection and management, you know, the optics and all the rest, the creation of mood. I mean, the music, Peggy Noonan was writing in the Wall Street Journal about the music that was playing after Obama stopped speaking by way of her, you know, clear, you know, admiration for the Reagan-esque kind of stage-setting craft. And then there was Obama who, you know, takes the gloves off. Then there was, you know, Obama, you know, you want to fight? Come on outside, John McCain. Yeah. I'll meet you in the alley and we'll slug it out, kind of thing like that. You know, what one conservative commentator called a manly speech. Yeah. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, the feminist in me was cringing. but the political realist in me was saying, you know, it did look pretty manly.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of scowling and growling. Absolutely. When he got to the global stuff and he started off by saying, you know, yeah, let's go outside and do it. I had a little bit the reaction, this is, you know, kind of coming back to a theme that we've talked about a few times now, that when he said, you know, hey, John McCain, I'm as tough as you are, I thought it came across, you know, I don't know how it came across to other people. Just to me, it came across as being a little defensive. It was, I know a bunch of people think I'm, you know, Obambi, and you're going to push me around, and, you know, I'm just, you know, all kumbaya all the time. But let me tell you, it ain't that way. And I thought if there wasn't this concern in the air about that, he wouldn't have had to say it. So I thought that maybe it worked. That's a, you know, a judgment call about whether it worked or not. And it didn't do much for me. And I also thought that the international part of the speech substantively was was pretty weak. I mean, it's, you know, all well and good to talk about going after bin Laden in his cave and the rest of it, but you know, the pumping up the importance of the use of more force in Afghanistan, where there's a real question about whether or not adding in more troops is really a good idea. The almost complete absence of any mention about issues of, you know, global warming and climate change. The almost complete absence of any mention of issues about dealing with, you know, extreme poverty and destitution in the rest of the world. And even on the security side of it, you know, Clinton made the very simple point that the big issue here is rebuild the alliances, rebuild this kind of, you know, and there was nothing quite so crisp said by Obama on that. On the domestic side, I thought it was, better. You know, I think probably the most time that got spent on any issue was on the energy stuff, and this is obviously an issue that he cares about, and where there's a real difference between the campaigns. I thought the other stuff, it felt a little bit...
But let me ask you this, Justin. Yeah. What is the background philosophy? I mean, he talked about it a little bit. He said, ownership society for the Republicans. And I've been waiting for this. You know, I've been waiting for this for a year. Yeah. I've been waiting to join the issue of the Reagan Revolution, 1980-1988, yeah. and the sort of whole conservative, low tax, government's a bad deal, you know, swing was in need of being refuted. You know, that a more social democratic vision. Yeah. No, we're not socialists, but we recognize the importance of government. We realize that, you know, the public sector has fundamental tasks to undertake that requires resources, which means taxing people in order to provide for the public good, and that the market needs regulation and a kind of setting of the institutional context within which competition and free and individual endeavor takes place in order to create a decent society. Okay. And to me, kind of that's like the fundamental issue of the last part of the 20th, first part of the 21st century. Communism fails, true enough. Hmm. You know, collective ownership and centralization doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that laissez-faire is the only option. And in a globalizing world,
I think you're asking an important question.
But therefore, join that issue and articulate what the democratic vision is that's the antidote to the bumper sticker simplistically stated Republican.
Yes.
Now, it seems to me he gestured in that direction.
So here's what I thought. There were two. There were a bunch of policies, but then there was a general philosophy that he offered. There was one point where he kind of gave a laundry list of the things, you know, the government is supposed to do the things that we can't do for ourselves, and it was a kind of public goods story, and that's fine. I don't think there's really very much disagreement about that. But the more general philosophical position that he presented was the idea that, you know, individuals are responsible for shaping their lives, for giving them direction and purpose, and for making something, making a success of the only life that we're each given. And that the rest of us, the society as a whole, acting through government in particular, is responsible for making sure that there's a kind of collective responsibility for making sure that when people make those conscientious efforts to do something with their lives, they have a fair shot at succeeding. And so that was, there was that idea about the division of labor between individual responsibility and a kind of mutual responsibility.
Yeah.
And I thought the place where he really could have nailed this issue as a fundamental division, not of personality, but of political philosophy between the Democrats and Republicans, is when he talked about his differences with McCain. And what he said there was, it's not that John McCain doesn't care about the lives of
people. He said he doesn't have a clue.
He doesn't have a clue. And I thought he could have said at that point, it's not that he doesn't care about other people's lives, it's that he's got the wrong view about what the common responsibility is. And
well, this
it's
is
not, yeah, it's, he did, he
no,
doesn't
I,
have
I think
the,
you, I agree with you. This is very important because the difference between those two arguments, the one of them is an ad hominem argument. I just mean that literally.
Right. That's right.
John McCain's a bad man. He doesn't have a clue. He's out of touch.
He's got seven houses or eight.
The other one is a substantive argument about how we view our mutual obligations together,
which
is what I think politics is meant to mediate.
Right. That's right.
And it's a claim that, you know, and he did say this, we're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
We're not on our own. We're all in this together.
Right.
And, you know, this resonates so much with me, as does what you just said a moment ago about the division of responsibilities between public and individual. I mean, it resonates with me because, you know, in some of my own writing and in some of your own writing of my writing, you being my editor, if people don't understand, on a piece that I wrote, and, you know, you helped me to come to articulate this very well. This is exactly what I wanted to say, you know, about in my particular case about criminal justice and punishment issues. But the thing is, okay, a person is responsible not to break the laws. That's their responsibility. But our responsibility is to create conditions of nurturance for their human development so that, you know, their array of choices before them is decent and humane. And then when they exercise their responsibility, they choose to live decently and not like animals.
Right.
But if we let them fester in their deprivation and then sneer at them when they fail to live up to our expectations about how they should exercise their responsibilities, when we could have acted in a more decent way, then we have failed our responsibility.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, there's an idea in John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, where it's a familiar idea, and he just gives, in a way, a name to it. It's the idea, what he calls fair equality of opportunity.
Yeah.
And the term fair there is doing some work. It doesn't mean just any old equality of opportunities. There's the equality of opportunity idea that says, you know, get the law out of the way. Don't have a caste society, and don't have an apartheid society, and don't have, you know, women or African Americans or whoever being excluded by the laws from attaining positions. And once the law gets out of the way, you're left on your own. That's not fair equality of opportunity. Fair equality of opportunity is the idea that it shouldn't matter, you know, what social group, class, or gender, or race that you're born into, that people who try equally hard and who are equally able should have equal chances to succeed. And that's what I thought, you know, when Obama was talking about individual and mutual responsibility and how they both have a role, and government has a role in ensuring that those conditions are provided that enable individuals to succeed when they try. I thought he was giving a, you know, voice to a view of that kind, about fair equality of opportunity and not just kind of, you know, equality before the law, as important as equality before the law is. And I thought there is a real division of a philosophical division there, and I thought he was sort of, you know, getting at that, but then let the ball drop when he said that the problem with John McCain is that John McCain doesn't get it.
Yeah.
Just doesn't share that political philosophy.
Well, that would have been the argument we political philosophers would have preferred him make.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if we're not being too ivory tower bound, and if he can't, you know, first of all, I'm sorry for how this sounds. Yeah. Not everybody's going to get that.
Yeah.
Okay?
No. Yeah.
Not everybody's going to sort of just get that argument or want to go into that kind of abstract way of thinking.
Tie it to education. Education is how you ensure that people who are trying, is an important way of ensuring that people who are trying hard, who have some skills and abilities, making sure that they have the same chance to succeed in life as somebody who comes from, you know, who's born with a silver spoon in his mouth and thinks, you know, born on third base and thinks he hit a triple.
Yeah.
Barack Obama is so far better than I am at turning, you know, abstract ideas into political rhetoric and images and policies as well. But I think that there is that real, I think there is that difference. I think he was kind of getting at it. And I also think, to go back to the difference between his speech and Clinton's speech, there was, Clinton talked about the failed Republican philosophy of the past 25 years, and then made the very good point that you only really saw this philosophy in full force
when the Republicans
after the 2000 election.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and you know, you see what it's like when it's lived out. But there wasn't anything about, you know, Ronald Reagan not getting it or John McCain not getting it.
Let me ask you a question, Josh. I just change the subject a little bit. Why was there so little mention of torture during the Democratic National Convention of 2008? I remember the Republican National Convention of 2004. Okay? I remember their savaging of John Kerry for not voting for this or that defense system. I remember Zell Miller, the Democratic former governor of and senator from Georgia, stand up there and give a keynote address at the Republican National Convention in 2004, not unlike what I imagine Joel Lieberman is getting ready to do in just a few days, and blast Kerry as being spineless and say he didn't trust his grandchildren in the hands of John Kerry. I remember that.
Yeah.
Now, we have had a government that has been torturing people, has nurtured a culture of lawlessness and contempt for the Geneva Convention that has made us a pariah. I mean, that is running a prison camp in Guantanamo that is, you know, et cetera. I could go on.
Yeah.
I won't because it's emotional. But what I'm saying is the Democrats had a convention and they didn't even raise their voices about the fact that the government in power is torturing people.
So far as I know, and I didn't watch the entire convention, but, you know, I The only mention that I heard about torture was a passing reference in Bill Clinton's speech.
Yes, exactly. That was my point. That's what made me think of it. When you were talking about how Clinton had laid out the issue of the 2000 election, and that's when we saw the true colors. That's what made me think about the torture issue, because I remembered the point. It was a very brief and passing moment, and yet it stuck out in my mind, because it was like he had a list of whatabouts. What about Katrina? What about torture? Yeah. That.
Yeah.
And each one of those could have been almost a speech on itself.
I was hoping to hear a little bit more about Katrina. Clinton mentioned it, and Obama mentioned it in passing. I wish he had spent another sentence on it, or two, or paragraph, or something like that.
Yeah.
The only mention was torture. But this really goes to the, we're running close to out of time, the one thing that we haven't done very much is talk about what the election is about. And,
That's one of the things
it's
about.
One of the things that it's about. It's about
Guantanamo.
And here, I think, this is why I think when people think about, what the choices are. When I make my own list about it, the Supreme Court comes out at or pretty close to the top. And I think the choice there is very clear. I mean, you can get with McCain a court that has, you already have Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Now you can get Clarence Scalia and Antonin Thomas. I mean, you can add
that's what he promised us.
And McCain, who had come out very forcefully about the torture issue, said after the Boumediene decision about Guantanamo and habeas corpus in Guantanamo, McCain said this was one of the worst decisions in the history of the Supreme Court. So that means that he thinks this is a decision that's like Plessy v. Ferguson. No?
Well, he's probably following Scalia, who said that it was going to cost American lives. Didn't Scalia say that?
He did say it was going to cost American lives. And, I think what you're going to get is a Supreme Court that is, we've been told, and people can make their choice. You're going to get a Supreme Court that's anti-choice, that's even more strongly pro-business, that is willing to accede to the suspension of the Geneva Conventions and torture, and it has a general philosophy of submissiveness to executive authority. There's no, that's not rhetoric. I mean, I think that's really the way the choice on the court is coming out. So it's a very clear choice, and this has nothing to do with the presence or absence of Governor Palin on the ticket. Foreign policy, I think the choice is also pretty clear. Not exactly clear how things are going to play out differently in the two in a McCain presidency and Obama presidency on Iraq, because it could be.
But here's what I fear, Josh. I fear that focus group or other polling inquiry has told the Obama campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, the flip flop on the Pfizer thing.
Yeah.
Right. On the exemption for telecommunications companies from being sued for engaging, that it's told them that that's a losing proposition. Mm-hmm. It is offshore drilling taken to a very high power. Much more powerful than offshore drilling. Looks like on its face you've got to be right about it, except that when it plays out in the living rooms of America, everybody wants to be safe. You can't win that argument. So you stay away from it, and you don't make it a matter of principle, and you don't draw a line that what we stand for is a government that would respect the Geneva Convention and would never think about undermining the institutions of justice in the United States, such as was done in the Justice Department et cetera. By having all this stuff go on, we believe in the rule of law.
Let me just tell you,
they don't believe in the rule of law.
We in the latest issue of Boston Review, the issue has just been printed and it's just started to go online. One of our articles is by Elaine Scarry, and Elaine's article is about why, as attractive as it is to move on from the Bush-Cheney years, we can't just move on because the rule of law is at stake, and that these guys really, Bush and Cheney, need to be prosecuted for, if they're not impeached, then you can follow the Bugliosi strategy of having prosecutions for murder. If they go overseas, you know, they can be, you know, somebody can be, you know, arrest them under universal jurisdiction, but that they have so damaged the basic institution of the rule of law that, you know, the law has to strike back against them. And it's a very powerfully argued piece that draws very substantially on the Bugliosi book, and also in this, you know, really quite remarkable Philippe Sands book, as well as the to a lesser degree the Jane Meyer Dark Side. But on that rule of law issue, look, I agree with you that they're not playing it up because of the politics of it. But I think we know when we move away from the politics and talk about what the election is about.
Yes, right.
I think there's a very clear difference between them on that. Also on the I don't know if you saw, there was a piece in the Times, I guess it was about a week or 10 days ago, about what McCain was doing immediately after September 11th. And this guy was the all-time cheerleader for fighting in Iraq. He was on to Iraq by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on September 11th. There was, I think, one episode of the David Letterman show during the anthrax issue where McCain speculated that maybe the Iraqis were behind the anthrax stuff. He said, of course, I'm just saying maybe. But, you know, and on the meetings in Bulgaria with, you know, the Atta issue about...
So he brought all of these very dubious stories.
I wouldn't just say, Glenn, I wouldn't just say he bought them. He not only
bought
them...
He was a Chalabi man. He was an Ahmed Chalabi booster?
A total booster. Yeah. And he was not only buying them, he was selling them. He was not only selling them, he was giving them away. Not only giving them away, he was paying people to take them. I mean, he was way out there.
Yeah.
I had forgotten about this, but this Times piece was really... So, you know, it really you could very well be looking at a foreign policy dominated by a bunch of, if I can put it this way, neocon dead enders. That, you know, it's the Iran stuff is characteristic there.
Well, does this foreign policy team consist of such people? I thought that was Giuliani's. Has he taken over? Have some of those people come over
yes.
there?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, he's a. Yeah. And I think though Governor Palin does not herself have very substantially developed policy views in this area, I think that there's a kind of an alliance there that is expressed in her choice. On if you come back domestically, so if you look at the court, it's a clear choice. Look at foreign policy, I think it's a pretty clear choice. If you look at wages and jobs, you just look at the record, the kind of thing that Paul Krugman has been writing about, you know, over the past 25 or 30 years, or Larry Bartels in his book about inequality in elections in the United States. Very clear choice, but it's pretty predictable that inequality will decline under the Democrats and will increase under the Republicans, that on wages and jobs, performance will be... I think there's a pretty clear... choice there on health care.
Well, I mean, you know, you got Robert Rubin or Larry Summers or Bob Reich or somebody like that on one side, and you got Phil Graham and the like on the other side. I mean, that's not very close in terms of you just, again, look, as you said, look back over the last 25 years and just follow the chart. I mean, we know what happened to inequality under Reagan. We know what happened to, under Clinton. I mean, big difference.
Yeah, health care, pretty, similar story. And, some basic basic issues like, I don't know.
Taxes
or, education. What do you, is somebody going to stand up and say that teaching kids science in science classes is, what we should be doing. I mean,
That was another one of Bill Clinton's whataboutes.
Yeah.
He had a throwaway line about, respecting science.
That's
or
right.
Something like that.
That's right.
It was like in that list of, four or five outrages.
Right. Let's go back, and then we can, maybe come full circle back here to Governor Palin, and then we should probably wrap it up. But, there were two issues about science. That one is... In the gubernatorial race in Alaska, the issue comes up about teaching
evolution.
Teaching evolution and creation. And creationism wasn't even really about, it wasn't about intelligent design or a little product differentiation there. It was about teaching creation, creationism. She didn't say, I haven't thought about this issue very much. She said, teach the controversy. The thing is, class, there isn't a controversy. There are a lot of controversial issues about evolution and debate, but there is no controversy, scientific controversy, between evolution and creation, evolution and intelligent design, for that matter. Like, who's the designer? What materials was he working with? What stuff did he make? And when did it happen? It's just not... I think it's great for students in school to be taught about that argument in the context of a history class or a philosophy of science class, for that matter.
I get it. No, it's in fact, it would be important because socio-political, about how societies actually process scientific information and what the nature of these arguments, what grounds are they decided on.
And also real important issues about the relationship between religion and science. That's a, hard and important issue, but it doesn't belong in a science class. And then to
I agree with you 100%, but John McCain himself holds the view that both sides, quote unquote, should be taught.
Well, I can understand that, and I also think that in psychology classes, people should be teaching astrology to teach the controversy. I mean, I think it's comparable. Human, behavior is a great mystery. Who knows how to understand it? Well, there are astrologists. And that's what they claim to do.
No dispute. But here, I want to put something in front of you, Josh.
Yeah.
So I agree with you 100% on the substance of what you're saying right now. Now, there's this cultural thing, like I was saying. The Republicans have managed to find a way of signaling or appealing to a block of the electorate. I'm talking about evangelical, Christian, homeschooling, anti-abortion, I don't mean this in a caricature to be disparaging. I'm just trying to describe an element of the population. They found a way of appealing to it. Now, in that corner of the culture, there are a lot of, aberrations or lacunae, whatever you want to say. And one of them is this notion that creation science and, Darwinian biological modern whatever on the same footing. It's a mistake. Yeah. It's wrong. Nevertheless, it's in some sense countenance. While it's a mistake that can be made without excluding you from polite company in American public discourse.
Yes.
Now, the South Side of Chicago also has its lacunae and its aberrations.
And the North Side does too.
Exactly. Yes, it does. Exactly. It does, right. And there's black liberation theology out there, or whatever the North Side might have.
Right.
Okay? And that is disqualifying. That is, the black liberation theology stuff, not everybody in America thinks like that, but a lot of the people in this particular community think like that. Maybe they have historical reasons for thinking like that. Maybe they need to be disabused of that thinking. Maybe that thinking is wrong, but nevertheless, they're still Americans. They're still patriotic, decent Americans. Maybe they're misled about this particular thing, but that's okay. They're still part of us. And I'm just trying to draw attention to the very different treatment in our politics.
Yeah.
Of the one versus the other. Because there isn't anything wrong with the South Side of Chicago, I want to say. Not basically and not fundamentally. So Barack Obama comes from the South Side of Chicago. That was his adopted community. That's where he was nurtured and reached his maturity. But now, necessarily, and it's not a slight on him, he has had to eschew and bury and paper over and make that, we didn't talk about Michelle Obama's speech. It was supposed to humanize them and show that they were decent. But there were no network cameras in the home of residents of the neighborhood where the Trinity United Church of Christ is located, in the neighborhood where Michelle Obama grew up, with cameras and microphones in front of the ordinary people sitting in their living room watching this historic event take place at the DNC convention. It just didn't happen. It's like presidents can come from Virginia and they can come from Ohio, and we can be proud of the great traditions of America that nurtures presidents. But when one of them comes off of the South Side of Chicago, suddenly that whole community has to be eclipsed and go underground and become some kind of unspeakable, un-American deviation.
Yeah.
When it's no more deviant than Sarah Palin believing that creation science should be taught, or that women who have been raped or the victims of incest should nevertheless have to bear that child.
Yeah. Well, there are...
In my opinion.
I understand, and I want to put that together with two other points that one of which will point to a next round of conversation, and one others which have come up here. So one thing that I was pretty... I thought the weakest part of Obama's speech was the end, when he invoked King, never mentioning him by name.
Yes.
Never mentioning what those people were gathered on the Mall about. Maybe it didn't, maybe it goes without saying, but I would have liked to have heard it. Never mentioning that this was about racial apartheid in the United States. So that was... And some vague invocation of, you know, don't look back, look to the future or something. I thought it was kind of weak. But the fact that there wasn't anything about what that struggle was about, I didn't like. I thought, as you mentioned, there was an invocation, both by Bill Clinton and by Obama, of Katrina. But there was no real reference to the fact that, you know, here you had just letting a poor African-American community literally sink. And the government sat by and did nothing and treated... It was a total disgrace. And there was yes. very little said about that. A third issue, which I think belongs as part of the same package and story, is 1 in 100 Americans in yeah. prison. Hugely racialized system of incarceration.
Yeah.
And this, even Bill Clinton didn't mention that. This is, I think, in your view, and in mine, I think this is something we agree. If you took the issue where the disparity between the importance of the issue and the amount of attention it's gotten is greatest, it's on that issue of the mass incarceration, particularly of black men. And the, you know, Obama mentioned it, but he mentioned it in the context. This is what he said. It was something like this: of course we should be providing jobs for people who've, you know, gotten themselves in trouble and helping them out, et cetera. But the main thing is we've got to focus on the fact that they need to make more responsible choices. And I thought, I haven't heard the of course part of that. There isn't any agreement that there's a problem about mass incarceration and about the fact that you've got such a large percentage of African-American men in particular in prison. And it's a disappointment about this campaign, but I think it's of a piece with the other things that you've been saying.
Yeah, I agree with you very much here, Josh. I think actually you're saying something important, that the evocation of King, it was wistful and implicit.
Yeah.
And here's what I want to say, because I want to tie it into the patriotism issue, to the, mm-hmm. you know, Obama telling McCain, come on, let's go outside. You know, you didn't like what I said, let's step outside, we can settle it, you know, man to man, kind of thing like that. Which is, I'm all for that speech about, don't question my patriotism, John McCain, mm-hmm. I'm not going to let you question my patriotism, I love my country just as much. But I would be uplifted much more by that if it were coupled with the claim that, and moreover, if I remember the fact that domestic American terrorism and violence mm-hmm. was the handmaiden of a system of racial apartheid that persisted for almost a century in this country after the emancipation of slavery, and if I point out that Martin Luther King Jr., who we remember here 45 years later for that great speech, which has become this iconographic aspect of the American narrative, was murdered... He's a martyr.
Yeah.
That doesn't make me any less patriotic than you. In other words, I wish that not only he had said some of the things that you were yeah. just speaking of, but that he had tied it to the claim that I'm no less American than you. And this relates back to my fact that there's nothing wrong with the South Side of Chicago.
Yeah.
Because on the South Side of Chicago, we know that domestic terrorism, I'm talking about Emmett Till, yeah. I'm talking about the four children in the Birmingham church basement, mm-hmm. and I'm talking about the ones who were buried in the dam near Philadelphia, Mississippi, yeah. and et cetera. You know, I'm talking about lynchings and a U.S. Congress that wouldn't pass an anti-lynching law for 50 years of the NAACP trying to get them to do so, and ultimately had to apologize for not having passed an anti-lynching law. In other words, for me to acknowledge that that's a part of American history that we now transcend and move beyond doesn't make me any less patriotic than you.
Yeah.
Don't just make the claim that you can't question my patriotism. Make that claim substantive by pointing out that I can disagree with you about some fundamental things, and you better not question my patriotism.
Yeah.
You know, who was more patriotic? Strom Thurmond? Or, you know, anyway, we could go on. You know, the guy, who I can't remember his name now, who ran on the socialist ticket in 1948 against the Dixie
Wallace,
Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was more patriotic?
Yeah.
Which one?
But here, we can wrap. Let me make one last point. We should bring it around. But I think there's a coupling here to the issue that we were talking about before about Obama's speech. So, as I said, I thought the end of Obama's speech was, I thought it fell a little bit flat. There was the invocation of King. It was, as you say, it was kind of, it was a little bit airy. And then he talked about, you know, don't look back. Look to the future. That's what's great about the country is we're always moving forward, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when in Michelle Obama's speech and in what she says about him, she talks about first hearing him talk and hearing him talk about the world as it is and the world as it should be.
Yeah.
And that she was really, you know, gripped and compelled by that.
Yeah.
I guess what I was a little bit disappointed in Obama's speech is I didn't come away with a picture of what of how he thinks the world should be. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of policies and there was lots of taking McCain outside. And then there were these, I think, very important invocations of the importance of civility and the importance of having a sense of collective purpose and the importance of having a sense of the United States of America, not just, you know, red America and blue America or, for that matter, purple America. But on that, the issue that we were talking about earlier about what's the guiding vision of the direction that the country should be going, you know, is the idea that there should be a system where, you know, it doesn't matter where you're born doesn't determine where you end up. Is that the guide? I think he could have come back to that issue at the end and not just talked about, you know, we're a place that we're always moving forward and never moving back, but talked about, you know, a country of racial equality, of gender equality, and of more class equality, where there's real equality of opportunity, and as I say, where you're born doesn't determine where you end up. And I thought it didn't. But it was, you know, listen, he's my guy.
I was going to say, you know, we're being pretty hard on him for his one speech.
You know, and I talked about on the issues, he's my guy, and let me just say again, he's my guy because of the Supreme Court, huge difference. He's my guy because he's less belligerent, huge difference.
Yeah.
He's my guy on jobs and wages, big difference. My guy on health, my guy on education, and my guy because I think he does care about getting back to the idea that, what you know, educating people about science is important and other things are important too, but you shouldn't be confusing them. All of those, I think, really important issues about the future, I don't see anything to choose. There's nothing to do with Governor Palin. I thought the speech was, I was not as moved by the substance of it, maybe as some other people were. But we should come back pretty soon.
Let me ask you something very quickly. You don't have to respond in length, but have you seen Gene Rivers' commentary on MSNBC during the Democratic
convention? No, I haven't been, no.
Yeah, so I have to confess that I actually do, turn into cable.
No, I watch MSNBC sometimes, but I haven't seen
Gene.
Well,
he was out there. He was out in Denver. This is Eugene Rivers, the minister from Boston, who was a personal acquaintance of both of ours, a friend.
Yeah.
And he was out there in Denver, I'm sure on assignment. I mean, he was, he was on the television commenting. I think I saw him sitting next to Patrick Buchanan at one point, you know, giving his commentary, his sort
Blood
of
brothers.
Color commentary on the thing. It was clearly a boost for him.
Yeah.
I thought that he didn't make a whole lot of sense in much of what he said, but it's probably not fair to him to say that at the end without having a chance to explain why. So, if you get a chance to look it up, I think you'll find it interesting. It's probably on the web somewhere. You know, Gene Rivers commenting on the DNC thing. I mean, he's got a new career now as they call him, you know, the Reverend Eugene Rivers, and he comes in and he gives the black urban church-wise but not a predictable liberal democratic view of things.
Right. So, yeah, that's what he's been saying for and, you know, he's a...
I think it's getting kind of tired.
It's getting kind of tired, but he's done some wonderful things, but...
Indeed.
There we are. Well, let's come back and talk about incarceration soon.
I'm for that.
Very good. Okay, good to talk.
Take care, Josh.
Bye-bye.
Bye.